Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Informal Paranormal. Today is Monday, June 21st, 2010, the first day of summer. My name is Doug Kelly. I'm here with John Rossi. Hey, John.
Hello, everyone.
Tonight, we're here to talk about stuff. This, of course, is a broadcast of Nexus. And tonight, and every Monday night, we're here to kind of be more informal, kind of shoot the bull a little bit, talk about various things of value to paranormal investigators and especially Paranexus members. But of course, this program is open to everyone. And we invite members especially to have an active role, be in the chat room. Anybody can ask questions in the chat room. Anybody can call in. And we especially encourage members to call in and just say, hey, John will be screening the calls tonight. And so just call in and say, hey, if you've got something on your mind paranormally related, maybe it's a case you've just done, or you have a question, or you have a perspective, you have something you want to throw out there that might be of value to others. You know, don't be shy. This is informal. We're just laid back, just talking. So be a part of it, and just join us. I mean, bring up an issue. We've got a couple things we'll talk about tonight. John, you're heading to Waverly tomorrow.
I am. I'm looking forward to it. It's our team's first paranormal road trip, and we're really looking excited. We've got some new equipment that we can't wait to put to the test. One of the people on our team took and had their Sony camcorder, sent it off to a lab, had it modified so it can record into the full spectrum, and ordered like three or four additional lenses so it can go into the deep infrared or go into the deep UV and everything in between. So we're excited to play with it.
Yeah, that's great. And you got your FLIR camera and
I do
miscellaneous gadgets.
Yeah, one of my newest gadgets just came from Hong Kong, and that's a little palm-sized portable DVR that has about a six-hour runtime. 8 gigs of memory, and I can run a video cable straight out of the FLIR camera right into that. And this little DVR is about the size, a little bit larger than a pack of cigarettes, and it's got a 4-inch monitor on it. It's the coolest little thing, and it was under $100. So
That's
hopefully
cool.
That'll be something we'll enjoy using.
Well, cool. So tonight we're going to get the discussion started off on the subject of poltergeists on Paranexus this afternoon. Brian Parsons, board member, posted an article, and it was entitled, I'm getting there, Have Scientists Found Proof That Ghosts Exist? And maybe some of you had a chance to look over that article. There was a couple of things that I had, a couple of points that I gathered from it. It's, it's an interesting stuff. It's about some investigation, especially over in the UK, where this investigator, Professor David Fontana, had investigated a poltergeist type of a situation back in the 90s, apparently. I'm not overly familiar with that particular case, but apparently they had quite a few things being thrown about, but it was, the way the article talks about it, was more of a playful thing rather than any kind of an evil thing, or mean thing. And this article really talks about and implies that poltergeists are some type of ghost, per se. Now, if you've taken the CPI course or if you're familiar with parapsychology, we pretty much think something different than that. We don't think of poltergeist, which actually means noisy ghost in German. we don't really think of that or view that as so much a ghost type activity as we do recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis, or RSPK. We often call it PK for short. That was a term brought about by, J.B. Ryan, I believe, and Roll. No, Roll coined that one. Dr. Roll. I knew that, too. I don't know why I said Ryan. Dr. Roll coined the RSPK terminology because he found in his research that this kind of phenomena was coming from a human agent, often an adolescent girl, but not always. And so, I don't know, I was reading this article about even some of these parapsychologists over there referring to these poltergeists as if they were some form of a ghost. And then I remembered, you know, poltergeist, noisy ghost. I'm thinking, well, okay, if a ghost is being noisy, wouldn't it be a poltergeist? Then I got myself in a logic loop and I couldn't get out of it.
Well, you know, I think part of what's going on here is, first of all, people are using the term incorrectly and at best loosely. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem is that they're describing the same types of behavior, or they're describing the same type of activity, but just because the activity is similar, or even if it's the same, it doesn't mean that it's actually the same thing. I know that sounded kind of confusing. What I mean by it is, like, for instance, if you see a dog running down the road, okay, four-legged animal, it's running down the road, and then you see a horse running down the road, again, another four-legged animal, that horse isn't a dog. And I think that's what's kind of happening with poltergeist-related stuff, is that people are describing the activity, but kind of just getting it mixed up in the process and saying, well, if this activity occurs, it's one thing. Well, no, it actually could be a number of things, because the activity itself doesn't define what's going on.
There you go. So if you have an opinion, our listeners, our live listeners, if you have an opinion or an experience with things moving around, or things that maybe you think were caused by a poltergeist, or you have an opinion on what a poltergeist is, give us a call. 347-945-7799. The number is there on your screen. We'd love to hear from you, or you can post in the chat room. The thing that I guess has always gotten me is, you know, John, you gave a good example of a dog and a horse, but, you know, you take somebody who is an accountant or an engineer or a plumber, you know, any of those, right? That's it's what they do, but it's different than they're a man or a woman or a human. You know, I mean, different type of thing. It's what they do. It's not what they are so much. And so I really think of, I don't even use poltergeist, the terminology, because it's often so misleading. You know, we use RSPK, or we use PK for short, type phenomena. But, you know, when you really think about it, if a ghost does move things around, they are using PK, right? Because, I mean, it's PK is psychokinesis, right? Moving things with your mind. I mean, wouldn't it be
Absolutely.
PK? So they are they're using PK, and if they're being mischievous or playful or whatever, they're moving things around, or they're being noisy, I guess the term strictly would apply, but I just think it's misleading.
Absolutely. Personally. And, you know, early on when they were doing research around the phenomena that was associated with a human agent as opposed to a spirit agent, you know, it seems like they were focusing on the turmoil of adolescence or pre-adolescence, particularly in females.
Right.
But, you know, based on some more recent cases, it really seems like just about anybody that has emotional turmoil, if you will, in their life mm-hmm. could potentially be an agent
yeah.
for that type of activity.
And the
you know,
evidence
I think,
that I... Go ahead, I'm sorry, John, go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't think that it's something that's age and gender-based. I think that it actually could include, you know, male and females, and any age, in particular, you know, without a, you know, specific age bracket.
I have also noted, like I've said many times before, that any time this kind of thing happens, they're usually psychically sensitive too. It's almost like the psychic ability that they may not even know about tends to manifest in these ways. And I've often likened it to the way life is. Some of us tend to have a propensity toward, I don't know, asthma, or you know, we're allergic to certain things, or you know, our stress manifests in maybe shoulder tension or neck tension or other body aches. I mean, there's just a variety of manifestations of things, and I don't see why psychic manifestations of PK activity would be any different. Does everybody do it? No, but it can happen.
Hey, Doug, in the chat room, Catherine's asking, are they ghosts moving it around with their mind or physically, but we just can't see them doing it, only the results of it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. The theory is that ghosts are energy, right? I mean, technically we're all energy, but ghosts are a different form of energy, so what are they using to move things around? Are they touching it physically? You know, if that was the case, they would have to have mass, which I think is generally suspected that they don't have mass. You know, who can say for sure?
Yeah, well, you know, I've actually felt that I've been touched before on investigations, and in ways that really, literally, not like a spider webby kind of effect, but, you know, like where a hand was actually, like, placed on my shoulder. And, you know, it had the sensation of mass and weight, mm-hmm. but when I looked, you know, there was nothing there. So, you know, I could see how that could be confusing for some people, just in terms of like, well, you know, it sure feels like there's something there. But, you know, I think that it really, you know, probably the best explanation based on what our understanding is right now is that we're looking at PK activity that's, you know, from the other side.
Well, that stands to reason, but I have to agree. I mean, I've been touched before, too, and, I mean, that happened right in my own home. I was sitting in the chair one night. We were watching TV, and I was sitting on the end of our couch, which is a recliner, and just sitting there, and to my right is kind of a walkway. It goes back into the dining room and kitchen, and I'm watching TV, and somebody touched me, like, with their full hand, you know, their full fingers, I should say, right on the neck. I mean, to the point where I looked around to see who was there. I thought somebody, you know, one of the boys or somebody had come up and you know, would just touch me. And I mean, it was absolutely, definitely a touch. It was not a tickle. It was not, you know, an itch. It was a touch, like the full four fingers of a hand right on my neck. And I turned around to see who was there, and there was nothing there. And I can't explain that. I mean, what was it? I mean, I haven't had it happen before or since, but that's a great question. If ghosts are not mass, if their form is not mass, how can they do this? I mean, is that mind as well? I mean, it's an interesting concept physically, you know, from a physics point of view.
Okay, Doug, so how do you differentiate when you're in an investigation if something is a poltergeist event in the sense that there's a human agent, or is it a intelligent haunting with PK activity?
How do I figure it out?
Yeah, I mean, what are the things that you're looking for in order to make that determination?
Things I'm looking for are, and I have to rule these out, you have to rule out human psychology. Is there a cause for stress? Are there teenagers in the house? And most of the time there are. And most of the time that you get this stuff, it is a female teenager, but not always. And so you have to look at what kind of stress is going on in the home. And you have to be good. You have to be good at this, and you have to have some experience with this. Because, and John, you know this, I mean, anybody who's had any experience know this. Sometimes in the family dynamics, if there's a dysfunctional home life, they can present very well. And they call that the family secret. The whole family knows it. But they come off as absolutely healthy and normal to everybody else. But yet, behind closed doors, it's very dysfunctional. And so you have to really be able to use discernment. You have to make sure and rule out that there's no toxic relationships, addiction, alcoholism, abuse, whether that's physical abuse, emotional abuse, or even child abuse or molestation, those kinds of things. There's also prescription drug abuse that could come into that. So I have to rule out all of the psychological factors before I'll even approach getting to paranormal. Okay. Isn't that about what you do?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Actually, there's a follow-up question to this from Catherine. If it's thought that adolescence caused the PK, why couldn't it be that it is the higher energy level from an adolescent that a spirit taps into or draws on in order for the spirit to cause the PK activity?
Well, you know, that's...
Well,
go ahead. You got.
I mean, right off the bat, one of the things that I see activity that's quote-unquote poltergeist-like, yet there is no human agent present. So there's not like the adolescent, or there's not someone that's got the high emotional levels that would suggest being an agent. They're just simply not there. They're not part of the equation. I'm not sure in terms of what Catherine's asking. Personally, I don't really think that spirits can, like, take the energy from you.
Really?
I know that sometimes on investigations, I come away feeling somewhat exhausted, but I don't think it's because, you know, someone's...
Well, I do too, but I think it's a lot of the energy you put into it.
Well, absolutely.
But I know there are people who have felt like they have been drained, and frankly, human beings can drain other human beings. We call them energy vampires, so... If
right.
we view spirits the same way as we view human beings, then it's conceivable and plausible that a spirit could do the same type of thing. My response to Kathy's statement there, or her question rather, here's the interesting thing. Could a spirit conceivably tap into that energy and draw from it and use it? I suppose so. I mean, you know, it could be. The problem that we have, you know, it's hard to do this. I mean, it's hard to figure out what's going on. You really need a lot of evidence. So let me put these out there. You got PK events going on in a house. You have to look at who is a potential human agent. You got to look at that. If you don't have a human agent, then you have a little more perhaps compelling evidence to suggest there's something beyond that. But is it plausible and conceivable that you could have a human agent and have a ghost? Sure. But in order to arrive at that conclusion, in my mind, you got to have some compelling reasons why. I would have to have some evidence to suggest, look, we've got this going on, but we've had some other things going on. I mean, even Dr. Roll had documented some PK activity that had gone on when the human agent was... out of the house. It was, I forget what he called it. It was, he had a term for it. I can't remember what it was. So, you know, now, could that have just been a ghost and not the human agent at all? Sure. But Dr. Rule doesn't believe in ghosts, so, you know, he's not going to formulate that or go there. It's hard to say. It's hard to figure this stuff out. And, you know, it's so confusing. There's so many variations on it that, you know, we got to keep collecting evidence. That's all we can do at this point.
Have you ever had a situation where there was poltergeist-type activity where you've also gotten EVPs?
Uh, I want to say yes. There was one case. I wasn't there, but it was a case we were doing, one of our chapters was doing some years ago, that there was some poltergeist-type activity, or I even hate to use the word, I'm sorry, PK activity, where the mother was actually, she was standing next, they had a pool table, she was standing or sitting next to that, and she was grabbed by the throat, according to her word, and thrown back up on the pool table and choked, being choked. And then it stopped. And I'm thinking we got some EVPs out of that, or some of them did, but I can't be certain. So that's, I guess I don't have a real good, solid case where I can say yes or no.
On that particular case, was the conclusion that there was a human agent?
Yes. Actually, I think there was two or three human agents. She had two daughters. One was 15, one was 19. The 15-year-old, when I initially questioned, this is what I was told. Nope, she's doing great, no problems at school. You know, I ask about boyfriends, nothing there. You know, no real reason for anything. And then it came to light later that, yeah, she did have boyfriend problems, she did have school problems, and she had lupus. So she had and not only that, her mother was in a relationship with an alcoholic. So there was all kinds of stress going on. The 19-year-old was pregnant, and, you know, not as much stress in her life, but still added to the whole thing. The whole family dynamic was dysfunctional. And so I have no choice but to say that's where that stuff came from. You know, that, and they were psychically sensitive to boot, based on, you know, our investigation. So I can't say, and it's so hard, John, because I was there once on an investigation. There was several investigations there. I was there on one of the first, probably the second one, and we were in a dark room. We were doing a vigil. One of the psychics was picking up this malevolent energy up in the attic, and I was confronting it, and there was an instant where I was confronting, and I was talking out loud. I was standing up. There were several of us in the room. I was talking to this entity. I wasn't provoking it so much as I was confronting it. I wasn't being mean. I was just being very direct and telling it, you know, come down and talk to me, that kind of a thing, you know. Let's talk. And for an instant, I felt something right in front of me. I saw this thing. I can't even describe it. I didn't get enough of a glimpse of it to even describe it. But I knew there was something right in front of me. But it was only for a second that I felt this. And at that very moment, I said, "It's standing right in front of me, isn't it?" And one of the psychics, the only one that was there, said, "Yes, it is." And that was an interesting thing. But I can't explain it. Can I prove that there was an entity standing in front of me? No. But it was an interesting experience.
Oh, it sounds like it. So, another statement from Catherine. So, if humans, while alive, can cause PK activity, then if spirits are just like us, then wouldn't it suggest that they could create PK activity also? So maybe PK activity can come from either source. Is that correct?
I would say yes.
Yeah, me too. Too.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. It's great to speculate and to brainstorm on this stuff and try to figure out what the possibilities are. I mean, it's so confusing at times. It's because there's so many variations. There are so many people who claim to have paranormal activity, but it can be explained, as we've talked about. I mean, 90% as a rough figure can be explained otherwise. But yet there are those compelling instances. We had Brad Steiger on Paranexus Universe, I don't know, a year and a half ago, or maybe it was just last year. And he talked about an incident where they were walking up some stairs and one or two of them were lifted a few inches off the ground and just set back down or dropped back down. And I asked him, was there a teenage girl there at the time? And he said, yeah, funny you should mention that. Yes, there was, you know. And so he was ahead of me on that one. They'd already figured that that was the cause of it. So, as Kathy asked, so it would be up to us to try to determine which source. Yeah, the answer is yes. And it's not always easy to do. And that's why you can't always just do one investigation. In fact, if you've got a good case, it may require several investigations. And that's is as it should be. You can't just go there one night and walk away and determine whether a place is haunted or not. That's not the way of serious research.
No, absolutely. One of the homes I lived at was a very, very active home. There was multiple spirits, and they were doing the kind of activity that, you know, frequently I'd have to explain to guests what was going on because something strange would happen or they'd hear something weird. And, you know, but the thing is like the house was incredibly active, but it wasn't active all the time. So, you know, literally weeks could go by with absolutely nothing happening, and then you'd have a period of time where there'd be all kinds of stuff happening. So, you know, the folks that make the mistake of just going in and doing one investigation, particularly if they've gotten some results that suggest there's something there, you know, if they have the opportunity to do follow-up investigations, it can be pretty amazing because it just starts filling in and there's more and more stuff and you get more and more different types of data. And the other thing is frequently when you do an investigation over time, you're also doing it when there's different either moon phases, different kind of weather conditions. So there's a lot of variables that change, and you can see whether or not that has an impact on the investigation and the activity at that location as well.
Yes, indeed. Remember why we're doing this. We're trying to figure out what's going on. So when you approach an investigation, try to get out of the mindset that perhaps you've learned from TV or anything like that. Remember, you're a researcher. You're going there to gather evidence. And yes, we're trying to help the client too. But we help the client by gathering research and trying to determine what's going on. And if you can determine, let's put it this way. If you go to an investigation and there are definite signs of toxic relationships, of abuse, whether it's alcohol abuse or addiction, or just a crappy relationship, stress in the home, any of those factors, unfortunately, you know, you try to help the client the best you can, but what are we going to do? Even if there is paranormal activity going on, how can we offer up objective evidence that something's going on when it can easily be dismissed as human caused? That's the thing we run up against. So when you're doing these investigations, go in with a researcher's mindset. Look for evidence that you can't explain readily, and don't be too quick to believe. I mean, really work it, and don't just assume. For example, EVPs, they're so easy to misconstrue, to misidentify. EVPs have a cadence to them. They have that's all I can say, they have a cadence to them, and you've got to make sure that you have a clean research environment. That means if you've got people in adjoining rooms doing vigils, you know, everybody's trying to get EVPs, I'm sorry, but any objective scientist is going to say, yeah, how do we know it wasn't the other room? And often it is. And we maybe didn't hear it audibly, but the recorder picks it up. And we know it wasn't anybody in our room, but we don't know that it wasn't picked up in the room adjacent to us, something like that. So you've got to be absolutely strict with your protocols so that you don't corrupt evidence. And EVPs, if you get one, you'll know you got one. We hear a lot of stuff that is nothing. It's just knocks or and then here's some other things. Think about it. If you get an EVP and it's echoing, what does that tell you? I mean, it tells you that somebody in the room, I've heard those. There's an echo. I've heard a lot of those, in fact. They'll hear an EVP very faint, but it's got an echo to it. Well, it's bouncing off the walls. That's not the way EVPs work. A genuine EVP, you don't hear it audibly. So it's not pushing the air. It's not vibrating the air. It's being transferred directly into the microphone coil. Therefore, you're not going to get an echo. That's physics.
Yeah. The other thing to talk about, too, is that, you know, when you have an audio anomaly that you hear with your ear, you know,
yeah.
In some ways, those you have to even scrutinize more than an EVP.
Yeah.
Because the likelihood is it's not something paranormal. But then again, you know, if you can look at the various things that would have caused the noise and rule them out, and you end up with that, then, you know, you end up with something that's, you know, at the end you have to scratch your head and say, wow, I just don't know. But, you know,
could be clairaudience too, but, you know,
yeah,
you need to know whether you're clairaudient.
Well, when you pick it up on, I'm thinking, you know, at Jordan Springs one time I was investigating, and I've got a recording. I was talking to this little girl spirit about playing hide and seek, and you hear this child's voice go seek like that, and you know there was me and an adult woman in the attic, and that was it. So,
did she hear it too?
Oh yeah, we both heard it, and we got it on the recorder. And you can hear me saying, you know, did you hear that? And rather excitedly, because it was pretty amazing. And, you know, it literally sounded like it was coming from right next to us. And the thing is, over time when you're doing these kind of investigations and working with the audio and stuff like that, you know, you start to get a feel from whether or not the sound is originating in the room or it's some kind of, you know, trick. The thing is, it's like at Jordan Springs, you know, I've probably investigated there now, I don't know, 35 times. So I have a pretty good idea how sound carries in various locations and stuff like that. And that's another advantage to working the location over time is you get to know it so you can rule out a lot of different possibilities because you actually understand that environment.
Right. And that's a good feather in your cap when you're going back to a place. The lone ghostman, in the chat room brings up a good point that the EVP could be a place memory. And if we think about that, you know, a residual haunting type thing, if an apparition could be imprinted upon whatever, whether it's the atmosphere or the geologic formations or whatever, it stands to reason that an EVP could as well. And another potential source for EVPs is PK activity on the part of the investigators. We don't want to dismiss that.
No, that's true. That's where there's advantages when you take teams and you split them up and rotate them through so you can see if certain things replicate with different people present.
Mm-hmm.
So that helps rule out that as the phenomena that's occurring. But Catherine's got another question there, Doug.
Go ahead and read it.
If there's a lot of stress or adolescence in the home or problems, that doesn't mean we could say that they are the ones causing it either, because in my way I'm thinking is that there still isn't full proof that those things create the PK.
Yeah. I mean, what I think she's saying is, you know, yeah, there might be adolescence in the home and stress. Can we still prove that it's not PK? Is that what she's asking?
I'm not sure.
Isn't full proof that those things create the PK? No, there isn't full proof, but there's been a lot of compelling evidence. There's been a lot of PK events associated with stress and adolescence in the home. And so when you get a lot of this type of evidence, you tend to think, okay, what's the connection?
You know, a lot of times what I will do in a case where there's, you know, well, any kind of paranormal phenomena, after we've done our initial investigation or ongoing investigation, you know, I meet with the clients and we discuss, you know, what we've gotten, and we discuss what it possibly could mean. And so, you know, if there's a situation where, you know, is it a poltergeist, or, you know, is it a spirit that's doing various PK activity, you know, I'll discuss both of those as possibilities. Because the main thing is reassuring the client so they know that they're not in danger, that, you know, this isn't something they need to fear. And, you know, you just work with the client in order for them to be in a better place. And I'm not really sure it's absolutely critical to have it nailed down whether or not it is one thing or the other.
Because yeah, these effects.
People, yeah, the, these people need to adapt to the effects as opposed to the concept, if you will. You know, they're the ones that have to deal with, you know, things stacked up, or, you know, things coming off of shelves and stuff. So, you know, you want to help them process that and accept that and understand that, you know, they're not in danger.
Amen. That's the thing we also need to, and we've been preaching that for a long time, you know. We can boil all this stuff down to two basic things, fear and confusion. You know, paranormal activity, it results in one of the two or both, fear and confusion. Fear on the part of the witnesses, or the percipients, or the people who are witnessing this stuff. Confusion so much on the part of the investigators, because we seemingly get conflicting pieces of evidence. One thing will tell us this, and something else will equally be compelling, and yet it will indicate a different thing, you know, an opposite thing. So fear and confusion, we don't want them to be afraid. We want to help them to understand that there is nothing to be afraid of. You know, ghosts are impotent. They cannot harm you. If they could, we would have one story after another after another after another, and we don't. Even these PK events are so rare. And, I mean, can they pull you, your hair, or touch you, or scratch you, or something, you know, push you, perhaps? But most of the time, any time that this kind of thing happens, it's usually an investigator, which then leads me to another aspect of this whole thing, which kind of relates to it all, including the getting of so-called EVPs and seeing things, is the role that intense belief or expectation plays, especially on the part of some of the amateur groups, where they go in, they're excited, they're on, you know, they're doing a hunt, they're looking for the thrill of the hunt, the chase, so to speak, and they can often go in with such intense expectations and belief systems that they get one thing after another, and this includes EVPs, and I firmly believe that some EVPs could be the result of PK on the part of the investigators, depending on who they are.
Well, I think that's absolutely a possibility, because, you know, some people come in wanting to see something or hear something, and essentially they make that happening.
We got to take all this into consideration, and one of the things that I really would like to reemphasize, and really want those who listen to this to really try to grasp it. When you go into a home, try to get a feel for the family dynamic. Try to get an understanding of what's going on, and use your own life experience. Now, if you're a little bit older and you've had some experience in life, especially some experience with relationships, that's going to probably come a lot easier to you. But you got to look and realize that these people are not a whole lot different than anybody else, us included. We're all human beings. We all have our challenges. We all have our gifts. We all have our crosses to bear, so to speak. We're just people. And so these people that we go in into their homes and do these investigations, we have to look at them as people. What's going on in the home? There are far too few families that have no real problems. Most families have something going on to one extent or another, to a greater extent or another, to a worse extent or another. So we've got to be able to zone in on that. So pay attention. When you are talking to people, do they talk a lot? Are they talkers? You know, do they have a lot of energy? I mean, my Lord, I've been on investigations where you couldn't get them to shut up. And they're just flooding the whole everything with energy, energy, energy. They're just going a mile a minute. That tells me something psychologically about that person. And I can tell you right off the bat, the chances are that they have serious self-esteem issues. They're trying to impress you with words. They won't quit talking, because if they quit talking, they will no longer have an opportunity to impress you. So, you know, it doesn't mean that everybody who talks a lot is that way, but so many of them are. And conversely, those who don't talk at all are very, very tight-lipped. Again, not a healthy place. So you've got to look at people and understand human nature, and get a feel for what might be going on so that you can gain a better understanding into what might be causing some of this.
Absolutely. Are you there, Doug?
I am. I was shutting up, letting you talk for a change.
Oh, okay.
Just talking about thoughts. I had to shut up. Wouldn't want to be a talk.
Well...
So, what we got? Any questions in the chat room here?
No, just some interesting comments, though. One of the things I'd like to just kind of piggyback on what you were saying, just in terms of, like, the clients and where they're at. You know, probably the biggest danger that a client faces, in fact, I would say without a doubt the biggest danger that a client faces in a haunting situation is when the fear runs rampant. And they become so frightened and just terrified by the events, that's where they end up getting into difficulties. I mean, a person ends up emotionally and physically becoming exhausted because they can't sleep at night and stuff like that. See, that's where, you know, someone who's serious about helping people in that situation is going to take the time to try and help that client get into a better place. I mean, you know, you were talking about some of the ghost hunter types that come in there, and essentially what they're doing is it's all about trophies. We want to get this EVP and post it on our website because that means we're good, or we want to get this photo. But that family ends up not actually getting helped because
right.
A family that's terrified, you give them a photo of a potential apparition or you give them an EVP and then you walk away, you've probably actually made the situation worse for them, or you could potentially have made the situation worse for them.
And that's true. We want to always remember, do no harm. I mean, that's our motto at Paranexus, do no harm. So weigh carefully what you tell a client. And, I mean, under no circumstances tell them things like, oh, yeah, man, we picked up some pretty haunting or some pretty weird-sounding EVPs. Sound like you got yourself a demon here. We're going to have to, you know, hunt for a demonologist to come in here and bless this place, or maybe you have a priest, but we need to get him in right away. That kind of stuff is from Hollywood. It's hype, and it's BS. If that was the case, again, there would be so many cases of it. If spirits were in a position to harm human beings, we would have by far more cases than we do, and we don't have any to speak of. And the ones that you hear about are just that, you hear about them. You know, can you even name a case where there was bona fide activity by a so-called demon or even a malevolent spirit?
No, I mean, everything that comes out is anecdotal, you know, third, fourth hand kind of stuff. You know, probably the most famous case, and it turned out to be a fraud, was the Amityville case.
Yeah.
You know, just in terms of the claims that, you know, the demonologists were making, the claims that certain paranormal investigators we're making, and then then we end up with deathbed confessions that, you know, it was all made up to make a buck.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you know what the thing is even though the word's gotten out on that case that it was just total nonsense, people still will use that as a reference point. Well, what about that case?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, unfortunately, I don't know, there's almost like there's a need for people to believe in the boogeyman.
There is. It's part of a human dynamic. We seek that. I mean, why do people go to scary movies? Because they like to be scared. Why do they go to amusement parks and go on the biggest roller coaster in the world? Because they like to be thrilled. And that's what there's that element to all of this. But as researchers, we got to get past that. It's thrilling to be able to record and get some of this kind of evidence, the rare times that it happens. But we really are looking to answer questions. And there's two points that I'd like to comment on from the chat room. Kathy asked a question, what do you suggest we tell them to make their living more comfortable? And I'll tell you what I tell people, and I have helped numerous people right over the phone without even setting foot in their place by telling them this. I tell them simply this: do not view spirits any different than you would view a human being. And they may have told me that, well, you know, the TV turned on by itself, or it switched channels, or the lights turned on, or somebody was banging in the kitchen. And so I ask them, you know, what would you do if a stranger walked in your house and started scaring your kids? What would you do? And they say, well, I'd, you know, tell them to get out. I'd call the police. And I'd say, okay, so you would stand your ground, right? You would take, not let them do that, right? Right. Well, don't view spirits any differently than that. If, in fact, the TV is switching channels or your kids are seeing things and getting scared, you need to take your power back and say, that's not going to happen in my home. And I tell them that what we've got here is a heinous boundary violation. If somebody walks into your house off the street without an invitation, that's a boundary violation. It's trespassing. It's a home invasion. And so I tell them this, and they say, wow, I never looked at it that way. I said, there's nothing to be afraid of. You need to tell them, you know, take your power back. Tell them very directly, you're not welcome here. This is not your home. It may have been your home, but it's not your home now. Therefore, you are not allowed here. You are not allowed to scare my kids. You are not allowed to switch the channels. You are not allowed to bang on the walls or whatever it is that's going on. And it's interesting, whether or not there's a ghost there or not really is immaterial. And I've said this 1,000 times, when a person takes their power back, their entire lives improve. And it's worked so many times. There's another thing, you go ahead and interrupt me, John, if you've got some.
Well, I was just going to piggyback one more time. When you're talking on what you said, if you're in a situation where you feel like the client can't do what Doug was suggesting by themselves, then help them do that. You could offer to come over, walk through the house with that client, and essentially have the client, you know, you can talk with them in advance, create a script for them. This is my house, I live here, and you need to stop what you're doing or you need to leave, whatever that person, you know, wants. You know, and help them, you know, help them script what they're going to say. And then walk with them through the house. Because they may have been, if you will, indoctrinated with a bunch of stuff that just simply isn't true. And they might just be at a point where they are too scared to actually act. They want to, but they just can't, you know, it's almost like that leap of faith. So you could help them, you know. But the other thing is, you know, you want to make sure they walk away understanding that they did it and not that you did it. Because, you know, you don't want to create a dependency situation where every time there's a bump in the night, they're going to be trying to get hold of you to come over and chase the ghost away or something.
Yeah, not good. And we're not doing them any favors either by creating a dependency. And so you're absolutely correct on this. We need to help them to take their power back in any time. Any kind of so-called paranormal, whether it's real or not, doesn't matter. anytime that it happens and it's resolved, it's resolved really by one thing: the client taking their power back, taking ownership back of their domain. That's what that's what fixes it in the end. Because you can go in and do a cleansing, but if that client doesn't buy into it or doesn't believe it, nothing's going to change. So it's really all about what the client believes. It's about what they think. And so what we do as investigators, we have to put on the coach's hat. We have to educate them. We have to help them to take their power back, to understand that there's no fear, nothing to fear. We need to do some coaching and just help them to take their power back. So there's another thing that I wanted to refer to is something that the Lone Ghostman was talking about, you know, not being able to find the answers in our lifetime. And that's kind of a sentiment that's been echoed by many folks, and they absolutely could be right. I mean, they might be right about that. In my way of thinking, though, I can't subscribe. This is nothing personal, and this is not an attack of any sort. I just want to express my viewpoint here. I can't take that attitude, because if I do, then in Doug's mind, I'm almost defeated here. If I don't think there's any possibility of finding an answer, then I'm just going to switch to something else, give it up. So I personally can't adopt that. I mean, they may all be right, but I have to keep looking. And I personally think that we're making headway. There is a lot of parapsychologists that are doing some amazing work. There's also a lot of parapsychologists that are inhibiting it. No different than in the field of ufology or science or any other field. We need to make sure that we're part of the solution and not part of the problem. I mean, we've talked about this before, John, where, man, some in the anomalous research field, and I use that to include all of it, some of them are so predisposed toward it's not real that they almost do a better job than some of the skeptics out there. We need to remain neutral. We've beat this issue to death on a number of shows. We have to remain unbiased. We've got to look at what we've got. What are the facts? What do those facts indicate? What are the what's the situation? What's the atmosphere? The atmospheric conditions? Gather all that data so that we can find patterns.
You know, coming in with, in the chat room, they're actually talking about preconceived ideas and stuff like that. You know, to already have a preconceived idea, you just need to be careful that you're not going to end up having that idea be a filter for all that you now experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because then what you're experiencing isn't actually accurate. You know, it's tainted because you have this agenda. You know, I know it's impossible to do this, but you know, try as hard as you can that when you're investigating, that you go in there and just be open to the possibilities. Mm-hmm. Wherever they go, just be open to the possibilities. Don't come in there already, you know, creating a small box that you now have to work within, because to be honest, I don't think that we have enough knowledge about this field, if you will, that we can start creating those kind of boxes. Because I just don't think we're there yet. So I try real hard when I'm going somewhere, not to come in with like an agenda, either to find something or to discount something.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you know, Doug, sometimes I really get surprised in an investigation, too.
Oh, yeah.
So,
well, let's put it another way. When you go on an investigation, think of it this way. When you get evidence, which you think might be an EVP or a funky video or a photo or something, or even subjective experiences, you get these pieces of evidence. Think of them as a sort of structure, a thing, an edifice, some sort of a little structure that's floating in the air, that's maybe hanging in there. And I'm using a conceptual idea now. I'm not talking about an apparition. I'm talking about your evidence. Okay, think of it as just hanging in the air. what is supporting that? And if you look at it, sometimes you'll see that there is something supporting it, but it's not paranormal. So what is your evidence built on? What kind of foundation does it have? Or your conclusions, what kind of a basis do they have? Do they have strong points of agreement, or do they have weak points of agreement? We have to look at it this way as researchers. We need to say, look, this is what my conclusion is. My conclusion is that we have a genuine EVP. Here's why. Nobody was present aside from two of us. There was nobody else on the premises. We both spoke on the recording, so you can hear our voice. The voice we got was neither of ours. It did not have any inflections of the human voice. In other words, it wasn't pushing air. It was something that has a different cadence. It does not fall in the range of human frequency, vocal frequencies. This is why I believe it's an EVP. Now you got perhaps a compelling conclusion here. But if you've got investigators running around or somebody's mumbling under their voice or you have an echo in the room, those are things that are weak points of agreement. They're not really going to support that conclusion. Make sure your conclusions are supported. Why is this important? This is why it's so important. This is why it's crucial. Because the validity in this day and age, the validity of any paranormal evidence stands squarely on the credibility of the investigator. You need to make sure that your reputation is pristine. That means being careful to not go out on a limb, being careful with what you say, yep, that's paranormal, because you know how this goes. Sometimes we'll say, yep, that's paranormal, and not too long after that it's brought out as a hoax. Think about the rather famous investigators that were part of the Amityville thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, one of the things I think that people would be, this is from an investigator standpoint, happier with, if they could get into the mindset that appropriately reviewing evidence and wherever that falls is the win.
Right.
You know, because a lot of people go to an investigation and they're disappointed because they didn't get proof of the paranormal or they weren't able to debunk the paranormal. And that's really not what an investigator is about. An investigator is about the effective collection and review of evidence. And when you've done that, that's when you're a winner and that's when you've succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
The actual result is actually irrelevant to you being a good investigator.
Right. Get the evidence.
You know what I mean?
And, mm-hmm. And with we're almost out of time. Man, that went fast. Excellent point, John. Folks, we're coming down to our last minute. Time went fast. We really appreciate your comments in the chat room. Please join us again next Monday night for another chat. Think about things you might want to talk about. It's great. You can call in. You can keep talking about things in the chat room as well. This coming Thursday night, don't forget Paranexus Universe at 9 p.m. Eastern. We've got a program on EVPs and the practical review of those with Dr. Ingrid Irwin and her colleague Dale. So please join us Thursday. Please visit Paranexus.org. We'd love to have you as members if you're not a member already. And with that, John, it's been another good night. Appreciate your time, man.
Well, thank you, Doug. I enjoyed myself.
Always. And we're going to leave you with Stringed Disco by the talented Kevin MacLeod. Take care, everybody. Have a great week. Good night. Thank you.
We'll be right back.